Is that up front?
Pardon?
Is that
up front?
Up front, okay.
And the first year, it probably brought in another 15,000.
Okay.
So I'd say that a book means you make about $1 million per book, because that book led to me being invited to write other books, invited to consult, and invited to give talks. And the talks I give, and the other books I've written, the columns I've written, the articles I've written, and the consultations that I do, I'd say that's about $1 million. Now, I just say I wrote 57 books.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have no interest in money. I have a big interest in not and having enough to pay the bills. That's all I've ever really cared about.
Uh-huh.
Conspicuous consumption is not a thing my wife or I do. But the money that you make from writing is inestimable, because if you're a writer, you're separating yourself from the ranks of so many people. As many people in North America earn their living as a writer as earn their living as a professional athlete, which is to say very few people do it.
Right.
And if you love to write, and it really means you've got to love to write, and you can put together a book and know how to promote that book, you'll find that it is an amazing door opener for you. You don't have to do anything further other than having written a good book and then learn how to be a speaker, because you're going to get invitations to speak, not only from the bookstore, but from universities in town and from companies that come to your town and are looking for speakers. So the amount of money you're paid to write a book can't be measured just by the advance or the royalties. It's got to be measured by what it leads to and the doors that it opens. And it's embarrassing, Terry, because so many doors open to you. I mean, we need to get other speakers in to give my talks, because I'm just too busy to say yes to every invitation.
Wow. So the book isn't actually the product. The book is a marketing tool that allows you to really get the real product of the speaking and all the other bits and bytes that go along with it.
Okay, what you said is correct. But the other truth is that when I wrote a book, that was the product. I never thought in terms of it lead to speaking engagement. I never foresaw that coming. I never knew they'd ask me to write another book. I never knew people would call me to do consulting with them, because I thought the book was the product.
Yeah.
Only later did I realize, gee, the book is only a means to an end.
Uh-huh. So how would you go about now if you weren't as popular and well-known in the industry? Say, for example, you love writing, like you said, you put together a good quality book, but nobody's ever heard of you, no publishers know about you, no nothing. Where do you go from there to say, get somebody to read that manuscript, to get it to the point that somebody says, okay, here's $15,000, go to it?
Well, the first time I was confronted with that question, I was so in the dark about the answer that I decided just to self-publish the book myself. I didn't know about agents, I didn't know about publishers, I didn't know about royalties, I didn't know anything except I wanted to write that book, earning money without a job. And so I just self-published it, which is a good way to start. Later on, I learned that by having an agent, which I ended up having, I could be free just to write and speak. I don't have to worry about, you know, finding somebody to sell it for me. I was just able to find somebody to take my book for me. And they could market it. They could take it to publishers.
Let's see. Sorry, go ahead.
I learned to be independent of publishers. I believe this is the Gorilla's Manifesto. Never do anything that you can delegate.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things about working with Hugh Hefner, I have never in my life met a person with less talent than Hugh Hefner. Man had absolutely no talent at all, but he had incredible vision as to where he was not talented. And he knew he wasn't talented in writing, so he hired people to be the editorial department of Playboy. He knew nothing about art, so he brought aboard great art directors. He knew nothing about photography, and so he brought along photographers. And so Hugh Hefner put together a very profitable and successful magazine, but he did it without having talent, but by realizing his own shortcomings and then finding people who he could delegate those things to. If you met him, which is not hard to do, he would tell you in a hurry, yeah, I have pretty good judgment, but I don't have any talent. I never did. And so it's the people, the ones who fail are the ones who say, I've got talent, I can do anything.
Yeah.
Oh my God, in most cases that's delusion city, because most people can't do anything. Most people have an ego that's too big to allow them to delegate. But not Hefner. Hefner had an ego, you know, the size of a thumbnail, and he just didn't it never got in the way. And so he was an amazing boss, because I thought bosses had big egos who yelled at everybody all the time, and they didn't realize that he was a very soft-spoken person, a very moral person, and a person who always had his readers first in mind. But he knew that in areas of judgment he was good, but when it came to the other parts of a magazine, he didn't know anything.
So his true talent really was then being a project manager.
Yes.
Excellent.
But he also realized that he should hire a few project managers who could do the job better than him.
Right. Well, what about
he had opinions all the time. If ever there was an argument, he'd give in.
Wow.
He'd always think the people who I hired, I should turn the decision-making process over to them. And he was right. I've met a few people like that, but the majority are the opposite.
Wow. So he's a smart, talentless man.
Yes.
Now, if we can just go back to the publishing side. You said self-publishing. What does that encompass? Now, I've written the book. What's the next step?
Well, these days, you've got to go to the University of Google. And when you're in Google, type in publishing on demand.
Uh-huh.
You'll realize now that there are publishers out there who will publish one copy of your book, and they'll probably charge you $30 to do it.
Right.
It'll be a gorgeous book. It'll be bound. It'll be typeset. It'll be on great paper. It'll look like a first-class book, and it will cost you $30. And if you want, you might want to sell that book for $70. And if it's a good book, there's lots of people who will pay that much. So publishing on demand is the fastest and easiest way to become published and to make sure you'll make money on the book. The first book I did, Earning Money Without a Job, I self-published it. I couldn't find any companies that would produce less than 15,000 copies. I mean, 5,000 copies. So I had to go to East Lansing, Michigan, and find a company who would produce 5,000 copies of my book. And that was not the most fun I've had in my life, finding publishers who will do that, but I did it. It was worth it to me. It opened enough doors that I was able to just really have a pretty marvelous life since then.
And then, how do you get now? Well, you got 5,000 books sitting in your garage. Do you have to go? What's the next step? You have to go to the bookstores, or what do you do?
Either you go to distributors, whose only job it is to distribute books to bookstores. Or you go directly to bookstores themselves, and they will give you 30 seconds to talk about your book, because they've got everybody saying to them, you should carry my book. And actually, they want to listen, but they haven't got time, so you've got to be able to summarize what your book is about in 30 seconds.
And you could base your whole summary on that marketing plan that you put together, your 7-step marketing plan.
Exactly.
That's
and
beautiful.
Address yourself to what's important to them, their promotion plans for your book. Yeah. They'll say, yes, it's a good book, and yes, it's going to be enlightening to a lot of people, but how are you going to promote it? How are people going to find out it's out there? Even if we put it in our bookstore, how are you going to get people to ask for it? So that's why we wrote a book called Guerrilla Marketing for Writers, which says this is how to get on talk shows, this is how to get articles about your book, this is how to put on seminars of your own, this is how to market a book, because it's known now that unless you market your book, it's probably going to fail.
Right.
You've got to market it. So the questions you're asking are just brilliant, Terry. What do you do once you've got a real good book? What then? And that's the right question to ask that most people don't ask. So you've got to find out. You've got to make the decision. Do I want to self-publish this and write little ads and sell it by mail order like Jay did? Uh-huh. Or should I try to get this into bookstores and get them to sell it? Like Jay did. I tried all those things for my books, and I ended up living by my credo of don't do what you can delegate. So I started delegating everything, and all I did was the writing, and that's the part I love best.
Okay, so you've graduated to the point where you've got an agent working for you. Is that something that, let's say somebody finishes off a book, could they take that manuscript directly to an agent and bypass all the other self-publishing bits and pieces?
Oh, yes. Yes, they can, and agent, just look at Writer's Digest. Writer's Market is a book that has all the agents listed there. They're dying to see manuscripts from first-time authors.
Okay, it's called Writer's Market?
Writer's Market. It's available at all the libraries. It's updated every year, and it lists all the publishers, what they pay, and all the agents. Agents take 15% of your royalties, but they make more than that for you because of their ability to know which publishers are publishing which kind of books now.
Right, okay. Is there kind of a rule of thumb? For example, if we put out a book on business or book on marketing, I think maybe some... That would be kind of a bad example. Let's say something specific, like you said, if I came up with the idea of guerrilla marketing for writers, what could I expect that one book could bring me in? When you did your first book, it was $15,000 up front and then $15,000 in sales. What could I expect now as a first-time writer getting my book out there for the very first time?
About the same.
Okay.
It hasn't gone up. It may have gone down because publishers know that 80% of books fail. They don't earn what it costs to produce them. So they're pretty careful in giving big advances to people.
Right. Now, what about the something like if you use Morgan James? Where Morgan James, you write the book, you give it to them, they read through the manuscript, and then you pay a fee to be able to be incorporated into their system, and they actually show you how to go through the marketing, what to do with your book, how to really kind of promote yourself and get the system flowing.
That's one of the things they do. They also service a standard publisher who just gets your book at the bookstore and sells it. But they do, because they're the intrapreneurial publisher, they show all their writers how to be intrapreneurs and market their own book. For a new idea in publishing and a very good one, David Hancock's a smart person.
Absolutely. Would you recommend going that route as far as... kind of
I recommend experimenting. I mean, I've got several different publishers, from the biggest and the oldest to new ones like Morgan James, and by experimenting with different publishers, I learn who's really pulling their weight and who's not. And when I self-published, I didn't think that was a bad thing at all. Self-publishing puts you in control. It means that you could only give your book to bookstores that'll put it on the front, in the front next to the cash register, which your regular publishers aren't going to do that for you.
Right.
And they're gonna make sure that you love what the cover looks like. But if you give it to a publisher, they're not going to care much about what the author thinks of the cover. They've got their own agenda.
Right. Okay.
So I think it's a good idea to do a lot of these things yourself. But if you read Guerrilla Marketing for Writers, you learn how many options you have, how many things you can do, and that these days it's really up to the writer. It just doesn't happen that you write a book and it automatically becomes a big seller.
No, it's kind of like building a website.
Yes.
Now,
if you can write a book and keep it timeless, That's gonna do the best for you, because that means when you write the book, don't say anything in it that will be soon dated.
Right. Yeah. Instead,
write the book in a way that you want it to be timeless. That's why books that I wrote in the 70s and 80s are still on the bestseller list, because I wanted to make timeless books, and luckily that happened.
Now the book writing part of it is one part, but you're also very strong on the copywriting side of things, I believe, aren't you?
Oh, I love copywriting, yes.
Do you have some sort of a formula when you sit down and you're going to write either a sales letter for a direct mail piece or a website, the front of a website, whatever, the index page? Do you have a formula that you kind of just follow along?
The formula that I use is, my favorite number is 10, and so I figure whatever I'm writing, if I could find 10 ways to compartmentalize it, in other words, if it starts with this, and the next place he goes to this, and then you go to the third thing, and I try to make sure that I'm going to cover 10 points. That makes it easy to write a book, makes it easy to write a sales letter, doesn't overwhelm me, prevents me from writing too much, or from writing not enough. So that's sort of an unwritten formula that I use. I try to break everything up into 10, and then it's easy to write, you know, 10 chapters, one at a time.
Right.
10 pages to the chapter, one at a time. And I that's the formula I use. And my formula is that I only work on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, and that I'm a fast typist, and all of my friends know that I'm not available to talk with them or 4 hours with them on a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. They respect that. So do my clients.
Excellent. So when you're writing copy, then, what about for a headline? How do you get an inspiration to, let's say you pick up a client for margarine. How do you get inspired and go about the research side and your headline and all that type of thing?
Well, I've never been inspired in my life except about my wife. I'm not inspired about anything I've done in writing, because if you wait for inspiration, it's just not going to come. Instead, I believe that good writing starts with knowledge. So I try to get as much knowledge as I can about the project at hand or the company I'm writing about. I try to get that information. The more information I have, the more creative I can be. And I never think in terms of inspiration. Just if that happened, I'd have written a one book by now instead of seven.
Okay. Now, what about a headline? Because that's the most important. Now, if you're at a completely different level, obviously, than 99.9% of everybody else. But if somebody's coming out, they want to learn how to write a headline, they want to learn how to write a sales letter. Do you have a guerrilla marketing book on writing, on copywriting?
Well, we have a guerrilla marketing CD on copywriting called Guerrilla Copywriting,
okay,
which is wonderful.
That's probably the best place they can go to learn about it.
I would say yes. And I know that the best people in the marketing world, if they have 10 hours to work on an ad or a website, they'll spend 9 of those hours on the headline. The headline should do one of two things: either tell an entire story or intrigue people as you're reading the rest of what you got.
Now, how long can that headline be then?
It doesn't really matter. There's no hard and fast rules. If it tells a story or intrigues people into reading more, it doesn't matter if it's 6 words or 4 lines. I've never seen anything written that talks about the optimum length for a headline. But I've seen a number of things that said, just what I'm telling you, that it should be telling a story or intriguing people into reading other things that you've written, the rest of the ad, the rest of the website.
Now, what about the rest of the website? Should it be long? Should it be short? What's the kind of rule of thumb?
The rule of thumb is to realize that the public's intelligence level is on par with that of your mother, and she's not going to win. She's not going to buy anything because of clever special effects or jokes. She's looking for the real style versus the real substance rather than just style. So you've got to give her enough information to make an intelligent purchase decision. Sometimes that's many pages of information. Sometimes that's just a few lines. The important thing to realize is that studies show time and time again, readership of a website or an ad or a direct mail letter falls off dramatically after the first 50 words.
The first 50?
50.
Wow.
But after those 50 words, nobody leaves. So what happens is that the people who aren't really interested, after 50 words, they realize they're not interested and they turn the page. But if they're interested, the more you write, the better. So it could be 500 words. And the important thing is, don't try to make it short. Try to give people enough information to make an intelligent purchase decision. That's not that hard to do. So don't ever bother yourself thinking, is this too long or too short? Think in terms of the person reading it. Am I giving my mom enough information for her to spend her hard-earned money on this product? Because if not, she's going to go someplace else.
To somebody who can write copy.
Right, but that's copy. They're not concerned with long copy or short copy.
Right, okay. The other thing that you'd mentioned a little earlier, Jay, is that you, with your first book, you basically wrote it because you were responding to a need because there were no books out there. Now you've started putting your books onto CDs. because people don't have time to read the books. Where do you come up with all this basically insider insight to know what's the next need and what are people looking for?
I just read. I read books. I read magazines. I read the internet. I read the news on Google. Watch television. I watch really whatever I watch. I go to movies. I travel. I don't spend any time in real research time.
So what kind of books and magazines are you reading?
Well, I'm reading magazines like Entrepreneur magazine or magazines about Video Today or magazines about the internet. I read The New Yorker, I read Esquire, I read Sports Illustrated. I read those three whenever I can, which means whenever I fly. I read Time magazine to keep me abreast of what's happening in the world right now. I read those magazines very regularly, and I read maybe a book every couple months.
What's your latest? What's the latest book?
The latest book that I'm reading is a book by Larry McMurtry, who wrote Terms of Endearment.
Uh-huh.
He wrote a book called Evening Star. Is the book Larry McMurtry wrote after he wrote Terms of Endearment.
Right.
He's an Oscar and a National Book Award, and he writes about the West, and I love the West. And he writes, his only reason for writing is to have enough money to buy more books for his book collection.
Wow.
That's what gets him going, is his collection of books. And so I've read almost everything that he has written. And I've got Malcolm Gladwell's new book, Blink, ready to read as soon as I'm through with The Evening Star.
Oh, you're going to love it. Did you read The Tipping Point?
Yes.
You're going to love Blink.
Well, I appreciate you telling me that. I believe in testimonials, especially from people like you.
Oh, gosh. I won't ruin it for you, but it is actually, I think, even better than The Tipping Point. And I thought nothing was better than The Tipping Point, but Blink, I think, even gets a little bit better.
I'm glad to hear you say that. That's good stuff to hear. Thank you.
So you're reading then. Do you kind of intersperse it between a little bit business, a little bit of marketing, a little bit of kind of the fictional, kind of a broad spectrum?
Yes. I do most of my reading when I'm flying.
Right.
I when I'm home with my wife, I don't spend much time reading.
Right. Oh, that's good. What's kind of, I guess if we could kind of switch gears, what would you attribute is kind of your secret to success? I mean, when you're back teaching at Berkeley and you write your first book, was it ever kind of in your mind that this could really take off and things could really happen and I could really reach the level where you've reached now?
No, that never entered my mind. I never think about things like that. I only thought that there were 300,000 people laid off in the United States the past month, and these people are looking for new jobs, but the same thing's going to happen to them the next time they try. They've got to realize that there's more to life than having a job. So with these people in my mind, I know that those 300,000 people are each one represents a family, and those people are suffering. They're not getting enough food to eat. They're not able to keep their car in running condition. And I wrote to help those people. That was the only force in my mind, was the people reading the book. I never gave thought to what might happen to the book. That's the furthest thing from my mind, and probably from most successful authors' minds. They're so interested in the topic they're writing about and the readers of that topic. That's what keeps them going. I don't know anybody who writes for the money.
That's beautiful. You are a living example of give and you shall receive, I believe.
Well, I've learned that from other people.
Now, what about a mentor? You had some pretty good mentors on your way through.
I never really had a mentor, Terry. I had great bosses. My first boss, his name was Howard Gossage, president of a small boutique advertising agency in San Francisco called Weiner and Gossage. And I learned from him how much fun the marketing business would be. And my next person who I worshipped at his shrine was Leo Burnett. He was my boss at Leo Burnett Advertising, and I learned so much from him. And from him I learned he didn't let people work after 5 o'clock. And he didn't want people to take home any work with them or ever to work weekends. He said, if you can't get the work done between 9 and 5, maybe you're in over your head and you ought to move to another line of work. And Leo showed me that every product has something about it that's fascinating, and that all my job would be to find what's fascinating and then tell the truth about it. So he made advertising seem quite simple and quite homey and not at all like it's portrayed on. And his sense of ethics blew me away. He was such an ethical person, and he had no interest in money. Leo lives on a farm outside of Chicago, where that average agent he was, and his great joy was in betting the egg money that he and his wife Naomi would earn by selling the eggs at their chicken spritters. So they'd go to a local racetrack in country Illinois, and they'd bet on the horses with the egg money.
Wow. So
this is not what you'd picture when you heard that he's running one of the most profitable advertising agencies on earth. That's created some of the most successful and long-lasting marketing stories. And he had doing it, but his work ethic was not at all what people think the work ethic has to be. He really thought he should get it done right the first time, and he worked very hard to get it right, but he was the one who coined that line that everybody's repeating now: if you reach for the stars, you're not likely to get one, but you're also not likely to come up with a handful of mud.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, Jay, you've given us an absolute, I would say almost, it's been almost like a two-hour course sitting in your classroom in Berkeley and going through everything. Do you have any last words of advice you'd like to kind of wrap things up with?
I'll give one word of advice and then two rules.
Excellent.
In reverse order. I'll give the two rules first and then the word of advice. And I think anybody who has spent the time hearing what you and I have talked about today, I think they're going to get the most out of it if they just remember these things. Number one, when it comes to succeeding with marketing, all you need is to start with a plan and then commit to that plan. That's really what marketing is all about, and that's how you make it work. And the other word that I want people to memorize, it's the word that is the single most important secret of marketing. It's amazing that there'd be a one-word answer to what's the secret of marketing. It's the same as the secret to having a winning radio show or a happy marriage or your likelihood of finishing the marathon that you started running. And that is, this is the word that will help you make your business a successful business where other people are falling by the wayside. And that is the word commitment. That's the hardest thing to do, but if you commit to your plan, I said, start with a plan and commit to that plan. It's not more complicated than that. What's hard is to commit to something, because most people, when it comes to marketing or anything, they want instant gratification, and that's not what I was talking about. That's certainly not what a guerrilla marketing is about, instant gratification. It's about eventual gratification. So my leave behind, take with secrets are start with a plan and commit to that plan, and know that the most important word in marketing and probably in life itself is commitment. And I hate admitting this in public, but mediocre marketing with commitment works better than brilliant marketing without commitment.
Have you heard the bacon and eggs theory about commitment?
No, tell me about it.
I think this is the most lovely expression I've seen. Is if you have a bacon and eggs breakfast, the chicken was involved, the pig was committed.
That's definitely the truth. That's what I had for breakfast yesterday.
I thought that was great. It was it's because it kind of separates the involvement and the commitment. It shows you what commitment really means. You're in it for the long haul.
That's really the truth. I thank you for that story. I will give you credit whenever I tell them.
Well, thank you. Now, Jay, how can people get a hold of you? The easiest, just if they want to get your books and courses and all the other extraordinary information that you have, where's the best place to go?
They should go to gmarketing.com.
And everything's listed there for us.
All the books are listed there, and the ordering facilities are listed there. Everything's there. If they want to get in touch with me, they should write a letter to Amy, my daughter, Amy Levinson, L-E-V-I-N-S-O-N, at gmark.com. She'll answer their questions. She'll enable them to get books. She'll get them through to me. She's a great gatekeeper and a terrific daughter.
Wonderful. That's great. Thank you so much, Jay. You've been listening to Jay Conrad Levinson, the master marketer of all time and the author of 57 different guerrilla marketing books, and myself, Terry Telford, from thebusinessprofessional.com. Thanks very much for your time.